my problem is I've always felt I catch fish really good with what I use. I don't need something I've never heard of before.
Time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
So how we doing, Roy?
We're doing good. We're doing good. Having a rough start to the turkey season.
You've gotten zero.
I don't want to talk about it.
Let's talk about it for 1 second. What seems to be the issue, Mr. Turkey Whisperer? What's going on?
I'm a fish whisperer, not a turkey whisperer, but I do whisper to turkeys, and I enjoy it. As I said, it is the closest thing in the woods there is to a chess match, and I really enjoy the chess match. But we're only 5 days into the season at this point. I mean, this will air beyond that, but we're only 5 days in. And I was up 3:20 the first day, 3:30 the next two, and 3:00 yesterday. I was happy it was pouring rain this morning because I did not go out. But I've been around birds every single day. I just have not closed the deal. So that's all I have to say about that. I'll let you know when it happens, because it will happen. It will happen.
Okay.
So let's talk fishing, though. This is the Angler Within podcast, and we do appreciate everybody who listens. We appreciate all the positive feedback. People have been texting me, messaging me through Instagram, which I tremendously appreciate your comments and all the kind things you guys are saying to me. I appreciate it tremendously. All we're trying to do here is get information out that I've garnered from 4 decades of writing things down diligently. I did get, just to give an update on my my bass count, which I know there's a handful of people out there that follow it. At last report, I was 170 shy of breaking 36,000. I said it would happen this month, and it will. I'm down to the final, 112, I believe.
To 36,000.
112 shy of 36,000. So,
are you fishing on Monday and, or no? Are you gonna fish Tuesday, Wednesday this week?
No, the first chance I'll get to fish is Wednesday, and then Wednesday I'm doing a striper trip to the Hudson River. So, never done that before. Looking forward to it. Going with a few guys. And
where are you going? Troy? Are you going up?
Near down? Troy, yeah, Rensselaer, Troy area.
I might see you. Are you in a boat or are you on shore?
Oh, no, I don't fish from shore.
All right, so I won't be on a boat, but maybe you'll drive past me.
I'll look for you.
I might be going. A very good friend of mine is going at 4. He goes 4 a.m. to 5 p.m. Puts a full day in. He goes out.
Okay.
There. I don't think I have
that
much.
Full day.
I don't have that kind of stamina for that. But I do know the importance of early based on tide. I'm assuming that he's going over to Post and Kill to get his fish ahead of time.
Yeah.
What do you use? Use live or use cut, or what are you using?
I've never done this before, and a friend of mine that I fish with, he's got buddies he does this with each year, and they had a cancellation. They had an opening, and he called me. He said, "Have you ever done that?" I said, "No, I've always been curious about it." He said, "We do it every year. It's a good time." He said, "It all depends on how the fish are running. But the reports are good right now." And he booked it back in January. He called me this winter. I said, "You know what? I've always been curious. Yeah, I'm in." So this is a charter trip. So I'll be relying on somebody else to find fish for me. You know, that doesn't usually happen. I'm usually that guy. But
there's a lot of standing and waiting on those boats.
Anxious to be on the receiving end and just experience something fishing wise that I haven't done before.
What time are you getting out there? Are you going out super early too?
I'll be up at 4:00 to be at his house at 5:00, and they meet up with the guy at 6:00, and we take off at 6:30. They do a half day trip.
Yeah.
Enough to see what's going on.
The muumuus are running. I mean, people are catching them 40 inches plus right now.
Yep. See that. I've seen that, and I got a second offer from a gentleman that I took out on a couple perch expeditions this year. I'm not going to mention his name because he's well known in the hunting world, but he doesn't seek any limelight. He's a tremendous individual. I consider myself to be fortunate to be connected to him. Anyway, I took him out on a couple perch fishing trips, and we had great success. And he called me, and one of the people that works for him had his best day ever 2 days ago, where they got a 45, a 43, and two 41-inch stripers, in addition to a bunch of other fish. And he said, if you're interested, let me know. I'll hook you up. So I told him I was doing it this Wednesday for the first time. And depending on that, how that went, he may get a call from me. So
speaking of fish, I got out yesterday. I sent you that photo. I'm on the board for 24 with a nice largemouth that on a Zoom Houdini Super Fluke Jr.
Okay.
I got it from Bass Pro. Got myself a new hat.
Giddy up. Thank you for representing.
Those hats are $5. That's incredible. Are they always that low?
No.
Oh.
That's a sale.
I almost bought two. I have to go back and get some more.
Yeah. We just had a spring fishing sale that just ended, so you caught it just right. Always good deals at Bass Pro Shops. And yes, I will shamelessly plug them every chance I get because they treat me extremely well. And I was a huge fan before I ever got connected with them. I represented them for nothing for years just because I was that was my deal. I was a huge Bass Pro fan. Still am. Nothing will change that. One of these days, I'm going to hook up with Johnny Morse because that's on my bucket list.
You know, for a big box store, their product is fantastic. Usually you associate big box with their generic stuff, but their own line of gear is great. They don't have.
Do you know how Bass Pro Shops got started? We will get into our subject matter for the podcast, but when Ray Scott started the Bass Angler Sportsman Society and did his first tournament in 1968, and they started having tournaments. Johnny Morris was in a handful of guys that fished those early tournaments. And when they travel out of their home state and go to a different state for a tournament, the guys from that state would tend to win with lures that the guys from Missouri had never seen. You know, somebody in Arkansas using an Okie bug spinnerbait. Well, we've never seen that, you know. So he got the idea. His parents owned a liquor store, the Brown Derby Liquor Store, I believe it was called. And they let him have a little space, like a 15-foot space in the back corner of the store where he could bring in these fishing lures from these different states and sell them. And that grew into reach more people. They came out with a catalog. And that's why we can get lures from anywhere nowadays, because Johnny Morris started that trend way back in 1972, just providing lures that people wouldn't normally have access to. And the rest is history. Built an empire. Built an empire.
Indeed.
So, let's get right to it. I wanted to do one because I find this interesting, and it's going to explain one of my self-imposed shortcomings. I wanted to do one on hot lure trends and techniques, because I've always been, I think, behind the curve on that. When something hot comes out, I'm always skeptical until I see people cleaning house with it. And then I go, okay, this is the real deal. And I jump on the bandwagon, but I'm way behind the curve on it. Just to give you an example, how influential the Bassmasters Classic is. I think the year was 1985. I would have to check, but I believe it was 1985. Jack Chancellor won. They were fishing a river, and he won it with a bait he had called the Do Nothing Worm. It was basically just a little 4-inch worm. It was a hot summer tournament. They used to have it in the summer back then, and fish were kind of sluggish, so he went with a small bait. But he fished it with a Carolina rig, and that was a common technique for saltwater fishing. Some people used it in freshwater, but it was used mainly for catfish and stuff like, you know, bottom feeding fish, stuff like that. And it was not a bass fishing technique until he won the Bassmasters Classic with. And then it became a hot lure trend. What the Carolina rig is it's also referred to as the old ball and chain. It's a way of putting a bait basically suspended off the bottom or dragging on the bottom behind a weight. And you can use like a half or three quarter ounce sinker, heavy sinker, so you can lob this thing way out there. On your main line, you slide that egg sinker and then you slide a bead on behind it and you tie your line to a swivel. The bead is to protect the knot from being mashed by that heavy sinker.
Is that what the bead's for?
That's what the bead's for.
I always wondered that. Okay, I had no idea it had to do with the knot. I thought it was just another like a simulator just to get the attention of the fish.
Well, it does two things. When that sinker, especially if you use a tungsten sinker instead of lead, it makes a clicking sound when it hits that bead, which draws curiosity from the fish. It is to protect that knot because that sinker sliding back and forth hitting that knot is going to abrade it. That bead is to protect that knot. You just use one that's got a big enough hole to kind of slide over the knot so it acts like a sleeve that protects it. The sinker will hit the plastic bead and not the knot. Because the bead slides right over it. And then to the other end of the swivel, the business end, you tie your leader however long or short you want. And a lot of guys used to use it in when the grass was low on the bottom. If the grass was 2 foot high, they'd tie a 2.5 foot leader so their bait suspended just above the grass. That was the theory, but a lot of the plastics weren't buoyant and they would lay right in the grass. But they were rigged Texas style and weedless, and the baits would slither right through the grass and the fish would pick them up. But we have a lot of baits now that are buoyant, like a lot of the Z-Man plastics have air pockets, and they'll float, and they're great for a Carolina rig. But that is a technique that is still employed today. And way back in 1985, we're talking what, 39 years ago, it was made popular for bass fishing. That's almost a 40-year-old technique for bass fishing, and it was really not commonplace until Jack Chancellor won the Bassmasters Classic with it. That was in 1985. I started using it about 1995. So I was 10 years behind on that trend, but I don't think many people use it today. It's basically a forgotten technique, but I still catch fish on it. And it presents, when you use a Texas rig, which I use a lot, talked about that, it takes your bait right to the bottom. When you use a Carolina rig, your bait is trailing behind that sinker. When you use a Texas rig, your bait is right against that sinker. So if you got like a 2 foot leader, if you want to drag that on it, if you want to rig a craw on it, that little sinker, if you just do it in little pulls and drag it, that sinker is making a little mud trail on the bottom. That draws attention. That draws curiosity from, and then they see that plastic crawl and bam, you're loaded up. It's the Carolina rig is an amazing technique. It's a little cumbersome to cast. Some people think it's boring because they're just dragging a bait around. They don't feel it's an active enough technique. But I'll tell you what, sometimes that is just the deal for fish in a particular mood. And to me, there's nothing boring about loading up on a fish. The Carolina rig technique works. There was another lure trend. I was way behind the eight ball on this. Fishing tournaments in the early 90s. I remember a tournament we fished on Lake Champlain. We're all at the ramp early one morning. It's like 5 a.m. We take off at 6. And there's this guy at the launch yelling, getting everybody's attention. I got sluggos here. I got sluggos. I got sluggos. If anybody listening doesn't know what a sluggo is, that was a technique that was popularized, I think, late 80s, early 90s. Herb Reed, guy from Connecticut, came out with a bait called a sluggo. It was not really like a plastic worm. It was, you didn't fish it like a plastic worm. Hard to describe what it's kind of like, a cross between, I think it was the precursor, the predecessor to the Gary Yamamoto's Senko, because you fished the sluggo the same way. You didn't work it like a plastic worm. You rigged it the same way, but you didn't put a sinker on it. You just threw it out and let it fall in the water column and would drag it around. And it caught fish, but this guy was in the parking lot yelling, you know, I got sluggos here. Everybody was running over there to buy these things because you couldn't get them for a while, I guess. And I'm looking at my partner going, what the heck's a sluggo? He goes, I don't know. I never heard of one. And my problem is I've always felt I catch fish really good with what I use. I don't need something I've never heard of before. But people were catching a lot of fish.
That's a very closed-minded approach, though, Roy.
Yeah, I know it is. That's my downfall. I'm always way behind on these cutting-edge lure trends, except for the ones that I come up with on my own. And then In Fisherman writes an article about it 2 years later, and I go, that was my idea. I didn't tell anybody. Now they're telling everyone.
So sometimes when you're out and about at flea markets, garage sales, that kind of stuff, you find the sluggos. I bought a package of sluggos when I was in South Carolina from a flea market one time. It was
Wasn't his company called Lunker City?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, Herb Breed's Lunker City Sluggo.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they still make them.
And it was a flat-bottomed, thicker version of a Senko.
The Sluggo was a good idea because it presented the bait in a way that the fish hadn't seen before. That's what gave it its edge. But when Gary Yamamoto came out with the Senko, he made it softer. The Sluggos were a little stiff.
Mm-hmm.
The Senko is very pliable, very soft, and he impregnated it with salt, which sinks in water. So the thing that the Senko had all over the Sluggo was that if you hook it wacky style, which is with the hook in the center, when it drops, both ends kind of wiggle as it free falls, and it looks like something that's dying and injured in the water. That free falling action, that slow, subtle, you know, the last few kicks of life is what makes the Senko such an effective, easy target lure for fish. And even when you rig it Texas style so you can fish it through grass, it still has that tantalizing fall that it's just light years ahead of the Sluggo as far as strike attracting qualities on the fall. I think that's why the Sluggo just kind of faded into obscurity. And when they came out with the Senko, I said, you know, I get frustrated with myself because I look back at my approach at these new lure trends. And when the Senko came out, I thought, why do I need that? I got Sluggos. You know, I didn't know how effective it could be until I saw the way it worked in the water. And the Ryan Coulter, the man who was my tournament partner for 14 years, he showed up one day with those. We were just fun fishing a local body of water, just bass fishing, just, you know, getting in our zone, just working together. And good grief, this was a body of water. It was the first time he'd fished it. I'd fished it for years and thought I knew everything there was to know about this place. And he was beating the pants off of me with this. I'm like, what is that deal? He said, it's a Senko. I'm like, oh yeah, I've heard about those. I'll catch plenty of fish with my spinner baits and my crank baits here and my jig. And I did, but good grief, he was lapping me, catching twice as many with that Senko. And I wasn't as slow on the curve with the Senko as I had been with other baits because he kicked my butt so bad that day. I went right out and said, all right, I need these. That won't happen again. And I've been using Senkos ever since to great effect. I mean, there's a lot of tournaments that are still won on those. And it's some people, like, good grief, I've done draw tournaments with partners where the guy just picked up a spinning rod and threw a Senko all day. And I'm like, you know, that's a good deal, but not for every location we've hit on the lake. But, and he did okay, but I think he would have done better if he'd used a jig in some of the spots like where I did and hooked big fish. That I can thank my tournament partner for introducing me to the Senko because he changed my mind in one day. And that's fast for me, but good grief. He beat me so bad, I went, I need to get those so that doesn't happen again. But now the drop shot, everybody's going to say, well, that's not a new technique. But here's, you know, it was not always around. A drop shot compared to things like a spinnerbait or a crankbait or, a buzzbait, a drop shot for us in the U.S. is a relatively new technique. It's probably been winning tournaments for about 20 years now. But I'll tell you what, the first time I was introduced to the drop shot was on an episode of Bassmasters about 30 years ago, maybe 35 years ago. They had a 3-minute segment on it during an episode. They were just doing a regular tournament coverage from one of the events that they'd had, and they introduced a new technique. They would always have at the end of the show, they'd wrap it up with like a pro's pointer, and they'd have the guy that won the tournament talk about the technique he used and show how he modified his bait or whatever. And at this particular show, they, for the pro's pointer, they just introduced, it had nothing to do with what the tournament was won on. It might have been just a review show or something like that on different tournaments. I don't recall specifically. This is 35 years ago. They introduced this technique. It was called the down shot or the drop shot. That was the only name they had for it because they gave the Japanese name for the technique. And when translated into English, it came out the every time lucky rig. And they showed how you had a weight on the bottom with a leader with a hook tied above it. And you could drop that sinker right to the bottom and just shake your bait. And it was just suspended maybe 8, 10, 12, 14 inches off the bottom. And you just nose hooked a piece of soft plastic on that. They had a drawing illustration of how it's rigged. And then they showed one in the water with an underwater camera. And the action on that plastic, I saw that little 3-minute clip and I said, holy cow, that is going to be a fish catching technique. Did I immediately go out and adapt it? Of course not. You know, when I started using a drop shot, about 5 years after people had been winning tournaments in the U.S. with it, which started happening in the, I don't know, sometime in the early 2000s, I would guess, sometime around there. Aaron Martins is the guy that really brought it to the forefront. And he was a California angler. And we lost almost 2 years ago now to a brain tumor. And he was an inspiration to many, myself included. He was referred to as the natural, and we lost a great one there. But he introduced a ton of U.S. fishermen to the drop shot rig because he was phenomenal with it, and he didn't like to use it.
So
he didn't like to use it. He used it often as a last resort, but he won tournaments with it, and it's a technique he didn't care to use. He'd rather power fish, but he was, I started using it at about 5 years after they started winning tournaments here, which is probably 20 to 25 years after I'd first known about it and saw how effective it looked in the water. I just didn't do anything about it, you know, and I'm always kicking myself for that because I could have been way ahead of the trend on that.
See, I'm surprised once again, because you're the guy that is always looking to learn and add more things and deploy more strategy. It's not an aversion to learning something new because you're not afraid of that at all, but
no, it's like my kryptonite. It's the chink in my armor. I need to get with the program quicker, especially when I see how effective that looks in the water. And if I was a fish, I'd eat that.
So what's a lure today that you know that you're missing the boat on based on how you've already done?
I'm a lot better now at keeping up to date. I've tried to force myself to not hesitate, I'll say. There's one they're using now that I've basically been doing the same thing with my squirm and shad. This is the latest one that has come out is because Jeff Gustafson won the Bass. Again, here's how influential the Bassmasters Classic is. He won last year using his Damiki rig, his forward-facing sonar minnow. It's a technique he uses where they're finesse fishing. That he's using his forward-facing sonar to see these fish and put a bait right above their head and just shake it. And when they're lethargic, they'll just come up and grab it. It's the same thing I do with my little 2-inch squirming shad on a 16th-ounce jig head. It's the same thing. When I saw what the Damiki rig was, I said, I've been doing that with a squirming shad for 15 years. Yeah, we use it in tournaments fish everywhere eat smaller fish. That's the whole reason the Squirmish ad works, the Damiki rig works, FFS minnow works. The FFS stands for forward facing sonar minnow. That's what this plastic was designed to be used with a tungsten head, because it gives you a better return on your sonar imaging if you're using forward facing sonar. They're building baits for that technology now, just because they show up better on your screen image. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I've gotten a lot better at getting on the bandwagon that we talked about, the drop shot. Another one that came out, a new lure trend not too long ago, the chatterbait. It's different than a swimming. You run it pretty much like a spinnerbait, but it acts more like a swim jig, but it puts out a ton more vibration than a swim jig. A swim jig is all visual. Spinnerbait is visual with flash and a little bit of vibration. Chatterbait's got a whole lot more vibration than a spinnerbait, but not as much flash. And it looks like a swim jig in the water. It just puts out a ton of vibration because it's got a blade that's what they call it, a coffin bill. It's a coffin shaped blade, and it sits kind of upright and catches and deflects and dumps water off one side, then the other, then back, and just vibrates like crazy. Great for stained, muddy, off color water. Great early in the morning if you got overcast skies, just because it puts out a lot of vibration, helps fish locate it. That was a very popular bait. I can't remember who the angler was. It was a tournament in Florida, and this guy came out of nowhere throwing this chatterbait and finished second in the tournament. But he came from way back in the field and started using a chatterbait the second day and shot way up the leaderboard and almost won. And he, on the weigh-in stage, he was talking about the chatterbait and how it turned his tournament around for him. And boom, next thing you know, everybody's making a chatterbait. And there's some guys out there that are really good with them. The most popular one by far is the jackhammer. And it's just something about that bait, the way they make it. It's cost a lot more than your generic ones and your off-brand ones, but it's worth it because it does catch a lot more fish. I got a bunch of the jackhammers, and I use them in bluegill and bait fish patterns because that's what I'm trying to replicate with it. I got on that lure trend quick. I use them a lot. I catch a lot of fish on the 8-ounce versions in a lot of the bodies of water I fish. That it's amazing how many fish they catch. Here's another one that was a saltwater lure. This was popularized by Chris Lane, who's sponsored by Bass Pro Shops. He's a Florida angler. Him and his brother Bobby fish and win a lot of tournaments. Chris won the Bassmasters Classic. His brother Bobby won the Red Crest Championship. And Bobby, right now, I respect him for this. He's fishing the EQ qualifiers, trying to get his way back into the Bassmaster Elite Series because he wants a classic win. And I hope he makes it. He's a tremendous angler. Big Fish Bobby Lane, they call him. And I'm a fan, as are many of the listeners. But his brother Chris popularized two saltwater things. One was the power poles. That was a saltwater anchor for fishing the flats.
It looks like a jack hanging off the back of the boat.
It's like grasshopper legs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're amazing. I haven't invested in them yet, but that's the next purchase because they hold you in position. There are certain techniques that they'd be ideal for when we're fishing a spot on a river. You don't have to constantly stay on the trolling motor. If you don't have spot lock on your trolling motor, get power poles. Or vice versa. They both do the same thing. They hold you in position, and you don't have to be dropping an anchor on a rope and pulling it in. I mean, that's so old school nowadays. They were a saltwater anchor, and Chris Lane was the first one to put them on a bass boat. The next year, a handful of guys had them. A year after that, everybody had them. Now it's a staple on bass boats. But he introduced us to the Whopper Plopper, a saltwater topwater bait, oscillates in the center, creates a tremendous turbulence on the surface, and holy cow, do fish blast those. I got on that trend right after maybe a year or two after, and they started making them in all different sizes. I've got a guy I fish with. I call him the Mad Scientist because he paints lures. He creates lures. He's always coming up with this stuff nobody else has thought of, and a lot of this stuff works. He paints whopper ploppers. He gets them in bulk from a distributor. In the clear, no hooks. He builds his own lures, and he's built me some whopper ploppers. We just call them ploppers because they're not the original, but the ones he puts together, and we put good hooks on them. Man, do they catch fish! And I mean, that's a topwater lure that's only been popularized maybe 6-7 years now, and I've been running them for probably 5 years. And we catch a lot of fish on them. The whopper plopper reminds me of the old Head and Crazy Crawler that had a body like the tiny torpedo, but no propellers. It had two metal wings that were hinged, one on each side, and they pointed towards the front of the bait, and they would fold up when you casted it. But when you started to pull it in the water, they would catch water and they would pop back on that hinge, and then they'd spread out to the sides. And it was called a crazy car because it would wobble side to side, and it sounded just like a whopper plopper in the water. It just rotated side to side. It didn't spin in the water. It just flopped from side to side to side to side. It was called a crazy crawler. Actually, my wife caught her largest bass, a 4-pounder, on a crazy crawler fishing in the dark at night. I don't know if she remembers that, but I sure do.
How long did that lure stick around for?
I bet the crazy crawler is a semi-collectible now.
Definitely. I'm seeing a bunch of them on eBay right now.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
What do they go for?
Well, I see one that's got the original box, and that one's a mouse-looking one. It's a wood mouse. That one was $75. Between 20 and 30 on average.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, because the original box.
Mm-hmm.
The boxes sometimes are worth more than the lure because people discarded those and put it in their tackle box.
Yep.
And, I mean, it's something that's been gone for decades, and if you find one, it's money. There's a whole market for lure collectibles, but the boxes are worth a ton of money. Here's a popular technique, and I jumped right on this, and there's a whole story to this one, and it's called the Ned Rig. Now, you're familiar with the Ned Rig, right?
Yep.
All right. Do you know the story behind the Ned Rig?
I do not.
Okay. There's an outdoor writer in Kansas. I say an older guy because he's in his 70s, and I can say that because I'm only in my mid-60s. So, yeah, he's an older guy, and I'm not. The Ned Rig was named after Ned Keady. He's a contributor to In Fisherman. He does a lot for In Fisherman, writes a lot of articles. Now, he's old school. He uses a small, like, 14 or 16-foot aluminum boat. I don't even think he has an outboard on it. He uses a electric trolling motor. He goes out with his buddies. He reminds me of somebody else I know because he counts his fish. Their goal is to try to catch 100 bass when they go out. That's their goal. Him and his cronies have done that for years. The Ned Rig came about because they use a lot of finesse techniques because you catch a lot more fish on that. They don't care about the size. They just want to see if they can catch 100. And this particular day, the fish were giving them fits. They weren't responding. They weren't biting well. He was trying everything. Finally, out of desperation, he took what we call a mushroom head, a small light jig. It had a mushroom-shaped head. It's like half a ball, but flat on the back, rounded in the front, flat on the back where the hook comes out. And he took half a Senko and he put it on that jig and started catching fish like crazy.
Hmm.
Well, it's a very finesse presentation with that light jig, fell real slow, and it's unobtrusive, non-threatening. It's an easy meal. Fish will check it out. You already got them. It's impregnated with salt, so when fish pick it up, they feel that enzyme, which everything in life has, and you got time to set the hook. So they named it the Ned Rig after the guy that came up with a technique, and because it got very popular, and they just started calling it the Ned rig. And then companies started producing Ned head jigs. They started, everybody makes those baits now. And that's one I jumped right on. And it is incredibly effective. It's amazing how many fish you can catch on that. The first time I ever used a Ned rig was on a lake I go to in the fall, in November. And no kidding, we caught 82 fish that day. And the guy that I fished with was a college student, good friend of mine, Nick Petru. I'll put his name out there. A lot of guys know Nick. He's a tremendous, tremendous fisherman. And I took him to this lake. He'd been using a Ned rig for a little while. That was the first day I used it. And I actually caught more fish than he did on his own technique. And that didn't usually happen. Nick's a tremendous fisherman. He's outfished me many days. And I respect his fishing ability tremendously. I learned a lot fishing with him. And the Ned rig is just, we were fishing 25 foot down and just throwing it out and just dragging it. And many times you wouldn't feel a strike. Just when you went to drag it, that rod tip would start to load. I was using a rod custom built for me by another college that Nick at the time was president of the bass club that I advised for the college in Cobleskill, New York, SUNY Cobleskill. I was the founder of the bass club and team, and Nick was the second president of that club. Prior to him, it was Eric Malone. Nick was the third president. There was one in between them, but Eric Malone was the first one who built me a custom drop shot rod, which I also doubled as my Ned rig rod. And that tip was so sensitive, when I'd go to slide that across the bottom, I would see it load a little bit more and I would know a fish had it. I felt two strikes that day out of, 40 plus fish that I caught. I felt two strikes. They were just holding on to it. But that's how effective the Ned rig is. And it's not always like that. A lot of times they'll slam it. But an interesting thing about the Ned rig, if you look at it, it's just a straight piece of plastic, usually only 3 or 4 inches long, no appendages. It looks like nothing. And you're thinking, why would a fish eat this? They're curious. Anything that's moving on the bottom, they perceive as life or food. And they're gonna check it out. And sample, especially something that looks defenseless. I mean, they eat a lot of crayfish, but if those crayfish are in a defensive posture, they'll try to swing around so they can get it from behind. So, I mean, this Ned rig looks totally defenseless. An interesting story behind this, and this goes to Berkeley, the Berkeley Labs in Spirit Lake, Iowa. They do more research and development than I think any lure company on the face of the earth. They have a tremendous facility out there. They came out with a crayfish body and were experimenting with it in their tanks. And this was about 2 years before the Ned rig came out. I read about this in Fisherman Magazine. They were experimenting with this crayfish bait. They pulled one of the claws off it, and it actually got more strikes than it did when it looked whole. So, guys, when you're fishing a cross-style trailer or just a cross-style plastic on a jig head or on a Carolina rig or however you're fishing it, if you will get those short strikes where they'll pull off one of the claws, now you've only got one. Don't always discard that bait and be in a hurry to put on one that looks right to you. Because in the natural world, if a crayfish has only got one claw, he's in trouble. And he's an easier mark for the fish. The fish in their tanks, it got more strikes when it had one of the claws removed. When they remove both claws, it got even more strikes. The interesting thing was they started pulling off all the legs and every single appendage till they got down to just the straight plastic body of that craw. With no claws, no antennas, no legs, no appendages whatsoever. And that version got more strikes from the fish in their test facility than any other version of that plastic bait. So they took it to the marketing department and said, "You won't believe how effective this is." And the marketing team said, "We can't sell that. Nobody's going to buy that because it looks like nothing. So they never went forward with it because they were right. Nobody would buy it. It doesn't look like anything that you think a fish would eat. It looks like a piece of plastic that had everything torn off it. Nobody's going to buy that. They were absolutely right. 2 years later, Ned Keady came out with a Ned rig, which was half a Senko on a mushroom head jig. They started making, but what do those baits look like now? All the Ned plastics that you see nowadays, they're a 3 or 4 inch straight plastic worm with hardly any taper at all. It looks like nothing. Berkeley had that idea 2 years ago, saw how effective it was, but never marketed it because they didn't think anybody would buy it. And I believe at the time they were correct. 2 years later, when Ned Keady's genius created the Ned rig, now everybody's buying it because they know how effective the Ned rig is because of all the articles that were written about the Ned rig promoting its successful fish catching abilities. So people at that time, now 2 years later, are looking for those type of plastics. If Berkeley had hit on that, the timing was not correct. That's the only problem there. They had a winner before people knew how effective it could be. And I agree. I don't think anybody would have bought it 2 years before they learned about the Ned rig. That's what popularized that kind of plastic. And I think the thing that makes it so effective, it looks totally defenseless. When you're moving it on the bottom, it looks like something small and alive, which is what fish eat all the time. But it looks unobtrusive, totally defenseless, and an easy mark. And fish are always looking for something they don't have to work to get. And that's what a Ned rig represents. That's my take on that. And that's my explanation of hot lure trends and techniques. I think I covered everything I wanted to.
Hot lure!
Yeah. Yeah, we can't do that.
Roy and I were getting down to some Rod Stewart before we jumped on the air. So it was
instead of hot legs, we were singing hot lures.
Yeah. So very good. If you guys want to add to what Roy has gotten into today or ask any questions, hit us up over at anglerwithinpodcast@gmail.com and check out Roy's Insta at all lowercase Roy Bilby.
No spaces.
No
spaces. And we appreciate you listening. We appreciate it tremendously. And we're just trying to spread some of the knowledge I've gained from writing everything down in detail for 4 decades and still do it. You had something you were going to add.
No, I'm good.
Okay, I thought I cut you off.
No, I just talked over you.
then you do the sign off with the Angler Within.
You want me to say it?
You do it and I'll finish it up.
Well, as always, it's our job to try and help you find your
Angler Within.